Council, rebuttal time?
I've got like 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Stephanie Mesplay. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Carol Sylvie. Now, Ms. Sylvie is asking this court to remand this matter for revision of the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Findings of fact must support conclusions of law. This is a basic tenet of law. It's an abuse of discretion if the findings and the conclusions don't match. In this case, we have the unusual situation where none of the findings, save for one, which I will get to later, are being challenged. Instead, what Ms. Sylvie is asking is that the court's ultimate conclusion doesn't match the findings. Specifically, Ms. Sylvie is challenging the distribution of property, even more specifically in terms of how the husband's 401k was distributed. And the court made a number of findings, a few of which are especially relevant on this appeal. If I could read one of those for the court, and that would be finding of fact number 32. Finding of fact 32 states, Mr. Sylvie's separate property will be awarded to him. The community property will be distributed unequally in favor of Ms. Sylvie. This allocation is reflected on Exhibit B, and I have handed a copy of Exhibit B up to the panel. In this long-term marriage, the court strives to treat the parties equally and to leave them in similar circumstances. In order to do that, the court will award maintenance to Ms. Sylvie as set forth below. However, the current cash flow situation means that it would be difficult for Mr. Sylvie to pay monthly maintenance at an appropriate level. The court will award more assets to Ms. Sylvie in recognition thereof. This is fair and equitable going forward and also recognizes the community funds Mr. Sylvie secretly spent on non-community purposes. Those expenditures played a significant role in leaving the parties in their current less than ideal financial circumstances. There are a few things in this particular finding of fact that I would like to emphasize. First is that the court uses the word community property. Now, courts could have said all of the property, community and separate, will be distributed unequally in favor of Ms. Sylvie. Or the court could have said the net property will be distributed unequally in favor of Ms. Sylvie. That's not what the court said. The court specifically uses the word community. The court also states in the same finding of fact that it is awarding more assets to Ms. Sylvie, not net property, assets.
Well, let me ask you a question rooted here in the facts of the case. Did you hand us up this Exhibit B to look at?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm looking at the student loans, and the student loans that were existing at the time of the dissolution were assigned to the husband, and that was in the amount of $72,000. And as I understand the student loan situation, correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the student loans had already been incurred, and that's what the $72,000 was.
That's correct.
Plus loans. But then, so you want to go back to the draft findings where she was getting $300,000.
That's correct.
401k. But then the husband comes in being invited to submit a memorandum and saying, what's wrong with these findings? He says, well, gee, you know, I'm going to have to pay student loans in the future, too. I mean, I'm obligated to, and I'm happy to, but that's going to be another, you know, he says at various times, $125,000, $150,000, $175,000. And it does look like these student loans are pretty expensive, and it does look like the kids are still incurring them, and he's going to be responsible for them. So why isn't it reasonable for her to say, the judge, I'm saying, she sees, oh, okay, I guess we didn't really account for those. I mean, I'm looking for, I realize she doesn't say this, but I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking this looks to me like a tenable basis for, you know, giving the wife less money from the 401k. Isn't that what's wrong with that line of reasoning?
Well, I mean, for starters, the court didn't do that.
We don't know what the court did. The court got his argument. He had all kinds of things that he said. He said, I have these loans to pay. I've got these other loans to pay. The maintenance is too high. You know, I don't have any money. You know, a lot of stuff, but he did talk about student loans. Okay, so our question is, was there a tenable basis here for the court to do what it did? And the court didn't explain, but nevertheless, the record is there.
The court didn't.
So what's wrong with this line of thought?
The court didn't amend its findings. It didn't amend this Exhibit B to reflect any additional debt. This is what was entered.
Well, I mean, I guess because those student loans really haven't been incurred yet, right? I mean, they're going to be because the kids, you know, you don't take them out until they're actually in college. I mean, until the year comes along where you have to make the payment. But that's how they had financed all the kids' education so far, and that's apparently how they were going to do it in the future.
Well, they hadn't been incurred at that point, but the court could have estimated how much that amount would be, given the fact that at least two of the children had already been in college for a few years at this point, and assigned that estimate as debt in this Exhibit B. It didn't do that. The court does note in its findings of fact that these student loans, the way that they operate, are the students are ultimately are also responsible for
these. I thought there were two kinds of student loans. They're the ones that the students took out. The kids took them out, and they would be responsible for. But then there's something called parent plus loans that the parents take out, and then the parents give the money from the loans to the kids to pay not for tuition but for all their other expenses, cars.
Parent plus loans, the parents co-sign on those loans. The money is given to the parents then pay the college, but the students are also responsible. And I believe that is reflected in the findings of fact. And if not, it is in the record.
Is there any reason to suppose, based on this record, that the students are going to actually pay off these loans rather than Mr. Sylvie?
I don't know that there was any testimony as to who would be, whether the students would be contributing toward paying off these loans. All of them are still in college, so there wasn't any testimony either way.
I thought Mr. Sylvie testified that he was accepting the responsibility of paying off.
He did. Yes.
Did you argue on reconsideration that these conclusions were not supported by her findings?
Yes.
And she disagreed with you?
Yes, she did.
So you're asking us to reinterpret her words of assets and property to have a different meaning than she ascribed to them, but she heard your argument and said, no, this is what I meant, and this does carry out my intention. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
We're asking this court to interpret what the court wrote in its findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mike Hunsinger on behalf of Paul Sylvie. I'm putting up on the screen the spreadsheet which I'll refer to the with respect to the division of assets and liabilities. I also will provide hard copies if the court would prefer both or is the screen.
We have one, I think.
Well, but that's
hers.
That's the court's one. This is slightly updated, which I'll address. But let me first, Judge Becker, let me address your point. You had it exactly right. First of all, the loans that are included in the debt for the student loans, which are listed as $180,000, those are totally separate from the student loans, which the student loans is money advanced directly to the child's college for tuition. The kids are obligated and only obligated, not the parents, for those. The parent plus loans, which consist of the $180,000 up there, are ones for room and board for the kids. Averages about $16,000 a year per child. Two Central Washington, one Central Michigan. And those Paul Silvey is personally obligated contractually. There's no joint ownership. There was no co-signing. It's a contract specifically between the lender and Mr. Silvey, which is agreed to by mom and dad, Mr. and Mrs. Silvey, long before separation. And the first of those contracts, the first of those obligations by Mr. Silvey were done in writing before before separation, and the obligation began before separation. Now, Your Honor, Judge, I don't know whether you call the other one separate or not. What we're talking about here is a husband and wife deciding that, Paul, you will be responsible for as many years as it takes for you to pay as much money as our kids are lucky enough to get to pay for their room and board at college. And Paul is contractually obligated to pay every one of those dollars. And over a period of the time between when the first child started college to the time the third one will complete college in 2 years, it'll be around $180,000. I would contend that that's a community obligation incurred during community to be incurred for the rest of the life of one of the spouses. But I put the amount that was triggered for after the date of separation in the separate property column just because. Sort of technically, it sort of maybe is. But one of the reasons I'm pretty sure that the court denied the motion for reconsideration is I provided the court with this math after she presented the draft findings and let the court know, you know, we got $180,000 of debt coming. And I think that's a pretty good reason why the court adjusted the assets. There are a couple of changes to what I put up on the screen here to the exhibit you have in front of you besides that. One of them is the asset that Ms. Silvey was awarded was the house, which was worth $650,000. The court quite properly deducted $60,000 for closing costs. That comes off the top. That reduces the amount that the wife is, the value of her asset, because, as the court quite prudently found in her finding of fact, this house that Ms. Silvey was awarded, 3,500 square feet, 4/10 of an acre, pool, where she's living by herself with one of the adults and has graduated, apparently still living with her, was unnecessarily large and expensive to maintain, so she's going to sell it. So the judge took $60,000 off. Ms. Silvey has not sold it. She's still living in that unnecessarily large and expensive house. So when this court decides whether or not it was a manifest abuse of discretion, the court needs to know that their $60,000 should be added to the value of that asset given to Ms. Silvey because she never used it. She's going to
sometime. Why isn't it reasonable to assume she will sell it?
Because, Your Honor, the law in the state of Washington is you only reduce closing costs if the sale is imminent. We don't just go into a truck.
You mean in a divorce case?
Yes.
We're evaluating the decision the court made at that point in time, not whether in retrospect their lives have changed so much that we're going to revalidate.
I'm providing the court information as to what actually took place. The other one that's not listed in Exhibit B, you will notice, is the 401k loan, which I circled there, $29,000. The court just left that off. I don't know why, but that is another obligation. That is, in fact, a community obligation that was incurred by Mr. Silvey in the course of having to borrow money to pay community debt. That was not included in Exhibit B. You will not see that there. And Mr. Silvey is still paying $990 a month against those loans. It's going to take him another year to pay those off at least. That needs to be allocated to Mr. Silvey.
Well, I don't know why we would want to make the decision that the court wanted to do that, because isn't the argument about that 401k loan that he was borrowing money from it so that he could waste it essentially by paying the rent on this separate apartment that his wife didn't know about?
Well, that would be the case with all the debts, and the court made a specific finding of fact that that's a community debt that he's obligated to pay. So there is no... And the court can make that claim just for just about any of them. For example, the other two debts listed
well, if it
there.
It isn't even entered on this finding, and if it's not on the exhibit, then how do we know the court thought it was a community debt?
It's in the findings of fact. Moreover, Your Honor, you look at these other two debts assigned to Mr. Silvey for Springleaf and Greg Miller. They're the exact same sort of debt. Those are debts that Mr. Silvey incurred, which could be characterized for any purpose. those just happen to be borrowed after the deed of separation, but they're included here also as a separate obligation.
What's your answer to the argument that the court's finding says assets? It doesn't say net assets.
Well, I can't imagine that's anything other than shorthand for the net assets. The court is obligated by statute to allocate debts and liabilities. And especially in this case where we have the one party who is obligated to pay for the what both parties testified was probably their single most important goal in life, and that is to make sure their kids get an education. For the one party to be committed to pay for what's going to be almost $200,000, that the court would not have taken that into consideration in determining what the ultimate allocation would be. And in fact, the court did include the $78,000 on Exhibit B. It's a spreadsheet. The court did not ignore that. And when the court was presented with the allocation of assets and debts in response to her proposed findings of fact, the court came up with a different number. And basically, that particular figure was by far the most significant aspect of the pleadings that I provided to the court, which wasn't very thoroughly addressed in the findings of fact. So I don't see how any court could possibly say, well, what the trial court was just referring to assets, included liabilities as the court had to do in the allocation of the findings and in the allocation of the spreadsheet, did not take into consideration, because she had to take into consideration, and she said she took into consideration, liabilities. Does the court have any further questions? For example, does the court have any questions about this goodwill and Sylvie Sports? Because that didn't come up. But
factually, do I understand correctly, there was no evidence from any source whatsoever as to a value for goodwill of the Sylvie Sports?
That's correct. That's essentially correct. But Mr. Sylvie's business partner, the guy running the business, provided every shred of paper he had to Sylvie's attorney for the finances. And they were tax returns and not much else, because this was a ma-and-pa operation that had no sales in 2011 or 2012. When they had sales in 2013 of $22,000, they managed to spend $40,000 selling them, so it was a loss of $19,000.
Well, was there an argument made by Mrs. Sylvie that goodwill, that the business had goodwill that should be valued?
Of course, she made that argument, but she forgot to introduce any evidence. And she cites in her brief Hall and Berg, which are the two big fundamental goodwill cases. And Hall, which is the 1983 case, the husband, he had two experts testify, an economist and an accountant, saying, my medical practice has no goodwill. The wife had evidence saying that it was about $100,000. The judge said, I'm going to pick $70,000 without really saying why it got reversed, for good reason. Then Berg comes along, and Mrs. Berg hired the then most prominent business evaluating expert, at least in this city, Art Bergman, who testified it was the goodwill was $92,000. The judge says, I'm not really sure about Mr. Bergman's opinion, so I'm going to reduce it to $42,000. Well, here, there was no Mr. Brueggemann, there was no economist, there was no accountant, not a lot of financial evidence, because there was not much activity in this corporation. So I'd like the counsel to tell you, if this were remanded back to the trial judge, what would she have to base upon the awarding of 5 cents to Goodwill, or $50,000, or anything in between? She was not provided with the tools she needed to do to apply the Berg and Hall factors that the appellant is citing.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
First of all, with respect to the allocation of debts and assets, all this information about whether the house was sold, whether it was not sold, the additional amounts, none of this was on the record, and the court therefore can't consider it. In respect to the 401k, there was no finding whether it was separate versus community. The findings of fact, the 401k loans were addressed in finding of fact 28, which just states that Mr. Sylvie shall be responsible for them. That's all it states. I'd like to turn briefly to the business valuation. Now, in Berg, there was an expert witness. However, the court found that the expert was not credible. Despite the fact that the trial court found that it was not credible, the Court of Appeals said you didn't detail your findings. You didn't go through the
factors. You say, okay, we asked the court to assign goodwill, and there was evidence on the record from which the court could have found goodwill. And obviously there had to be some goodwill, so the fact that the court found zero has to be wrong.
That is correct.
What if the court found it was worth $5? Would you not be making this argument?
If the court had addressed it, we may or may not be making this argument. But the court simply didn't address it.
Well, why isn't zero within the scope of the evidence?
The court didn't say zero. The court just didn't address it. The court's findings of fact on this business are very slim and inadequate under
the absence of a finding is treated as a negative finding where it's been raised. And you did raise the issue.
We did raise the issue. However, the court didn't address the evidence that was presented. And I would briefly point out footnote 4 in Marriage of Berg, I believe, is pertinent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Move next to CNR Electric versus Johnson.